Hello and welcome to a special episode of Brain in a Vat. Today we have Brad Duchesne from the Psychological and Brain Sciences Department at Dartmouth. And Brad's here to talk to us about faces and interesting conditions that involve misperceptions of faces. Brad, would you like to start with a case?
We've been working with a gentleman for about a year and a half now. I first heard about him early on during COVID, and we didn't do any testing with him. The way we do a lot of the testing with people who see distortions when they look at faces, which is a condition called prosopometamorphopsia, we do a lot of our testing on Zoom. And he, though, doesn't see distortions to faces on screens. He only sees distortions to faces in everyday life. And this, none of the other participants that we're working with show this dissociation, although it's been reported a time or two in the literature. But so that made it difficult to test him. But in August of 2022, I went to his home and tested him, did about an hour of testing, didn't have a lot of time. But first of all, we established, yeah, he sees a distortion on every single face he encounters. And that began about 2 years before we did the testing. He woke up one day, and since that morning, every face that he has seen has really intense distortions. So features are pulled back. So the ears are stretched back, eyes are stretched back, mouth, nose is kind of flared at the end. He likens them to demons. His first thought when he woke up and all faces appeared like this, he didn't know what to make of it. He said to us, you know, I thought maybe I died and gone to hell and I was surrounded by these demons. Fortunately, he went on Facebook, I think it was, and posted about this. And somebody who was aware of PMO, prosopometamorphopsia, was able to tell him what it was that he was experiencing. And we eventually got in touch with him. But he doesn't see these faces on screens. And that's really surprising to a vision scientist because, you know, as I'm looking at your faces here on the screen, how's my retina to discriminate between whether I'm seeing a face on the screen or in daily life? There's very little difference to as far as the visual system knows. And yet these are treated, at least in this participant and appears in a few others, although it hasn't been well documented, very differently. And so he lives this interesting life where every face he encounters, if he goes to Walmart and he goes shopping, everybody walking past him has this demonic look, but then he goes home and watches television and all the faces look perfectly normal.
I mean, it seems unsurprising to me that Hollywood would just be angelic, you know, and it's the average Joes who are the demons. I wonder how people, as you mentioned, he had a particular interpretation of what was going on, which was to draw on religious language and see people as demons. I saw in some of the other literature, someone else saw what she called dragons in people's faces, and that it seemed that her hallucinations weren't just limited to faces. Can you tell us a bit about the variety of ways in which PMO manifests?
Sure. We see a very wide variety of distortions. In fact, I wouldn't say there's any sort of, we don't have any typologies here. I mean, there are simple things like, does it affect the whole face or does it only affect the half the face? Either full, we call it full face or hemi-PMO. But in terms of the nature of the distortions, they really vary widely. So that participant who was reported in 2014 saw faces as dragons. And in fact, I've heard from two other people who reported seeing dragon faces. So presumably in these cases, memories that these individuals have within their visual systems are playing a role in what they're actually perceiving. It's not just a bottom-up process, but you've got some memories in influencing things. We hear from other individuals who see features sort of seem to melt down. So they seem to droop. There seems to be more drooping than features going up, although we certainly see individuals whose features go up. We were working with a young man the other day, and when he would look at a fixation point in the center of the screen, the face would stretch toward the fixation point. It was a pretty long way. It was about halfway toward the fixation point where the edge of the face would end up. We were shocked when he marked on the Zoom screen where it was that he was seeing the edge of the face. And he likened it to the way the Dementors look in Harry Potter. Let's see. So those are some examples. Some people see texture distortions. So they might see One woman we're working with has seen skin sort of turn to a bark-like appearance, tree bark-like. Another time she saw skin turn to look like potato skins. And another thing we've had people report, and this is kind of like the dragon faces, rather than seeing the person who they're actually looking at, they'll see someone else's face in place of that. And often there's some resemblance between the two, but sometimes there's not. One person has told us he's had experiences, and this is fairly common for him, in fact. He'll say to his sister, hey, look at that person over there. Doesn't that look like grandpa? In fact, is that grandpa? And his sister will say, not only is that not grandpa, but that's a woman in her early 20s. And so no resemblance at all between those two faces. And so, yeah, we see a wide variety of distortions.
So that's very interesting, because I imagine that there'd be some people with a very different condition called prosopagnosia or face blindness that might report something similar, although maybe not replacing an old woman's face with a young man's face, but they might misrecognize someone as someone else. So how would you sort of distinguish between someone's face who's morphing into someone else versus just a misremembering?
Yeah. It can be a fine line sometimes. It's kind of a gray area. So our lab also works, I mean, for 25 years or so, we've worked with people who have prosopagnosia. So they have difficulty recognizing facial identity. And these people with prosopagnosia often have difficulties with other aspects of face perception as well, reading facial expressions, knowing, say, whether they find a face attractive or not, these sorts of things. Usually what they'll report is that a face doesn't look familiar to them. It's not that they're seeing a face and they think it's somebody else they know. It just doesn't evoke a sense of familiarity to them. And it often seems that faces are not all that distinctive one to the next. And so seems like a different sort of experience than what these people with, some people with PMO, where they're misrecognizing a face and really seem to be pasting on a different face onto the face they're perceiving.
So what do you think is happening then, or what in the brain is happening to cause this incorrect perception to be pasted on?
We don't have any idea at this point what's going on. We can speculate a bit about some of the regions that it might be taking place in. We think when we've got distortions affecting both halves of the face, that it's likely that sort of distortion is going to be occurring in the right hemisphere. The reason we say that is because we see, when I mentioned that some people see distortions only to one half of the face, left side or right side, that's called hemi-PMO. That tells us right there, the two halves of the face are represented separately from one another within the visual system at some point. We presume they're fused at a later point, but at some point, probably early in the face processing process, they're represented independently. And then interestingly, if somebody, let's say we're looking at a face, left and right is a source of constant confusion where we're talking about PMO. But if we're looking, imagine you're looking at a face, a participant with PMO, and if they have a distortion on the right-hand side of the face, sort of their right-hand side, in every case that has a unilateral lesion, so a lesion to one hemisphere but not the other, that lesion is in the left hemisphere. And so what that tells us is that right half side of the face is represented in the left hemisphere. That also indicates the left hemisphere is not represented in the left-hand side of the face, because we don't see hemi-PMO on the left side in the left hemisphere. If you've got a lesion to the right hemisphere and only the right hemisphere, we see all manner of distortions. So we see right half, left half, and both halves. And so what that tells us is the two halves are initially represented separately in the two hemispheres, and then they're brought together in the right hemisphere in what is certainly the most well-known. Maybe I should back up a sec. Within the brain, there are maybe 12 to 14 what we call face selective areas. And these are little blueberry-sized regions that are composed nearly entirely or maybe entirely of cells that are responsive to faces and not responsive to other sort of categories, or minimally responsive. And so these 12 to 14 areas form a network for face processing. The first one that was identified and the most well-studied is an area called the fusiform face area. And so we think that it's in the right fusiform face area where these face halves are brought together. But we don't have a lot of evidence, but that's our best guess.
So I'm interested in the idea that people with face blindness would struggle to recognize if someone was attractive. I wonder if they are nonetheless attracted to particular people and what's driving that, if not recognition of the face. And then I also wonder about the other mechanisms that people have developed so that they can recognize the people that they know in their lives if they can't recognize the face.
Okay, those are two good questions. So I'll start off with the attractiveness one first. And in fact, I was reading, we have a website, which I love to plug, faceblind.org, where we hear from people with prosopagnosia. We also have another website for people with face distortions. But I was reading through new entries from faceblind.org this morning, and a couple of the responses that I read talked about attractiveness. I would guess that 80% of the people with developmental prosopagnosia can process facial attractiveness in a typical way. Like if you give them 10 faces and you ask them to sort from least to most attractive, they're going to sort them in a similar fashion that people with typical face processing do. But there's that 20% who don't sort them in a typical fashion and appear to have problems with facial attractiveness. So I remember hearing from people who've said things like, you know, my girlfriends and I sit in the bar and men are walking past and they're talking about which guys are attractive and which guys aren't. And I have no idea what they're talking about. I just look at the faces and I just don't pick up any attractiveness signal, which might be a nice way to be, frankly. One thing that I've heard from a number of people, including one of the people whose entries I was reading this morning, is that people who don't perceive facial attractiveness typically often are attracted to people who are distinctive and who they're going to be able to recognize at a later time fairly easily. So the really tall person or the person in the wheelchair or somebody who's got a distinctive mole, things like that. Those are the things they're attracted to because, not surprisingly, because they can recognize them later on. Your second question, many people with prosopagnosia, it's not that they have zero ability with the face. So the face will play a role in their ability to recognize people, but then they use the many other non-facial cues that we can use to recognize people with. So particularly if they're in a place where they've got it, you know, imagine you're in an office with 10 people. Most people with typical face recognition, you could probably have somebody walk into the office with their face covered and they're going to know who that person is because they can look at that person's body shape. They can hear the person's voice. They can look at the hair, all these other features that we use to recognize other people. And they rely more heavily on those features than other people do. Some people tend to specialize even. So I wrote my dissertation. I collected data from a guy named Bill Schozer, and Bill had one of the first websites about prosopagnosia on the internet. He published in maybe 1996 or so. It's still up, FaceBlind with an exclamation mark. And Bill grew up in a small town in which, say, in the 40s and 50s, and most kids wore the same jeans every single day. And so Bill learned to recognize people based on their jeans. And there he was in San Francisco in the late 90s. He was still relying on jeans to recognize other people. And it almost seemed like the genes sort of had more meaning to him than normal. Like he sort of got almost personality, a feeling about personality when it came to the way people's genes looked. And I remember one day we were walking along the street talking and he said, oh, you know, I remember last time you were up, you wore those 505s with a little cut on the back of the right leg. So I got home and, oh, yeah, my genes do have a cut. So he was really tuned into that. And so just trying to make the point that people with prosopagnosia often will focus on particular things. And if you do that, then you're going to be in better shape the next time because you're going to look to the same part of the body.
So something interesting to note is that when lay people are told about face blindness, the name face blind is often quite misleading because people who are face blind can see faces. They're not blind to faces. They don't just see a piece of flesh, but they just can't recognize them from day to day. And one of the best analogies that I've heard is if I were to swap out your houseplant, which let's say is a lily, for a very similar looking lily, would you even know? So long as the pot was the same, you probably wouldn't know. That's what faces are like to face blind people. But when you tell people who've never heard of face blindness what it is, they often misidentify it as PMO, as being a distortion. That when people who are face blind look at faces, the face changes or it looks weird or they just can't see it. So am I getting this distinction correctly? PMO people will see a distortion, people with PMO, but people with face blindness won't see a distortion.
That's exactly right. Yeah. So, and it's not that one can't be both prosopagnosic and see face distortion. In fact, we're fairly confident at this point that people with prosopagnosia do have elevated rates of face distortions. But for the most part, people with prosopagnosia do not see face distortions. They see faces. And one sort of way to describe it, it's not that they have trouble telling faces apart. Their big challenge is seeing faces together. So they encounter somebody one day, then they see them again, and they don't make the connection between those two faces. They don't see the similarity between the fact that you're seeing somebody at time one and time two. So they have trouble seeing faces together. And the faces are not changing on them, whereas in PMO, they usually can see active changes of the face. They look and the eye might be sort of moving down the face.
So can you tell us a little about the hallucinatory effect of PMO and how it would compare to other kinds of hallucinations? So I gather, for example, there's some research about people who take DMT that they will see similar stuff. People talk about machine elves, like these geometric sort of moving parts, these sort of beings that they're seeing, or they'll go to a landscape in their minds that is similar to what other people will describe. Now, I gather it's because the psychoactive substances are acting on parts of people's brains, and that's eliciting a certain kind of result. And maybe you'll get some variety with it, and maybe you'll get some consistency with it. So can we learn something from the two parallel fields that teach us something about the other?
Yeah. So I'm not familiar. I have heard from one person who face distortions emerged during an ayahuasca ceremony, and they've persisted since then. I'm not familiar with that literature. I am familiar with some evidence suggesting that when people take psilocybin, they're more likely to experience face distortions. In fact, I have some firsthand experience with that. Certainly that seems to go on. In fact, we're talking with a PhD student here at Dartmouth who works. There's a lot of people at Hopkins, as you might know, who are working on psychedelics and sort of the potential benefits that can emerge with psychedelics. We're wondering if in some of these studies we can show people faces as well and see what sort of face distortions they experience. So presumably these drugs are having some impact on face selective areas. And we know they have impacts on other areas of the visual system. I mean, it's not uncommon with people on psychedelics. If, say, they look at a popcorn ceiling, they're seeing some motion there in the ceiling. You ask about hallucinations. And sometimes it raises the question of sort of what's a distortion versus what's a hallucination. And I don't think there's a clear dividing line. Something one of my PhD students and I have talked about quite a bit. We tend to call something a distortion if there's a real resemblance between sort of the stimulus that's actually out there in the world and the stimulus that's sort of changing and not reflecting that. But I don't think there's a real clear line between it. And there have been some real nice studies. This is probably worth introducing. So there are nice neuroscience studies in which you've got patients who are going to undergo surgery for epilepsy. And one of the things that the surgeons want to do is they want to figure out, well, where is the seizure starting? So often they're going to be recording from a number of different brain areas, let's say in the week leading up to the surgery. And if they see that the seizure is beginning in a certain region, that's the region you want to cut out because you're more likely to be able to control their seizures with that resection. While people have these electrodes in their brain, you can send a little current through the electrodes and see what effect that current has on their experience. And so when you've got an electrode inside a face selective area, what you see is phenomena that are very similar to the face distortions that you see in PMO. And so you stimulate, say, the right fusiform face area, and the participant might say, one half of your face appears to be melting down. In other cases, though, it's not just a distortion, but it's an actual hallucination. So there was one kind of fun example of somebody who was looking at a photograph of a car, and in the rearview mirror, they saw a face when one of their face selective areas was stimulated. It was interesting that it was right in the mirror where you might actually see a face. Or there was an example from another group. Somebody was looking at a soccer ball or a volleyball, and one of the face areas was stimulated. They now saw an eye. It wasn't even on the ball. I think it was to the right of the ball. But so they were hallucinating an eye there. And so you can get both distortions and hallucinations from the same sort of manipulations there. And so they're very, very closely related to one another.
Does the person with PMO know that there's a difference between reality or not? So listeners might not know this, but I have PMO. It's how I know Brad. So for many, many years, I believed that my one eye was smaller and higher than my other, until I met Brad and got diagnosed and then realized that actually my eyes are the same size and level. But for many, many years, if I looked in the mirror, that's what I believed. So for me, it wasn't like there's a distortion happening in front of me with my own face, at least a distortion happening in front of me, which then I could see that there was a change. So the original face must be different from the face that it lands up as. But when I look at other people, there's usually a movement. And then I kind of know that the original face is not what it lands up looking like after the distortion. Do people with PMO generally know that something has been distorted, or do they just think this is the way people look?
Yeah, so that's a great question and raises some interesting issues. So I think it's going to depend on the origin of the individual's PMO and also the type of distortions they have. In the great majority of the cases, in fact, every case in the literature is an acquired case. So these are individuals who had normal face perception, and then they began experiencing face distortions. And so that's fairly obvious to people when that happened, not surprisingly. And so they notice that difference. There are other people, though, who we've now heard from a couple people who it seems like their distortions might be developmental in origin. In fact, the person who I was mentioning who might think he's seen his grandfather when it's actually a 20-year-old woman. And he gets sort of more typical distortions where he's seen things move. And so it appears that you can have PMO due to developmental causes, and we're hoping to publish a paper on that just to establish that fairly soon. But there are also some acquired cases, like the case I was talking about earlier where the faces look demonic. There's no change in those faces when he sees them. They just look demonic. And so you imagine if there was an individual who had distortions like that and they were developmental in nature, they would just think that's how faces look. And they would not understand that they're seeing faces in a very different way than everybody else does. And so I suspect there are people like that out there. I don't know if we'll ever hear from them, because they're never going to realize that they're seeing faces in a different way. It's similar to when people have color deficiency. So they're missing a cone type. They're perceiving their color experience is very different than the color experience of other people. And it picked up most of the time probably now, but undoubtedly there are millions of people out there in the world who don't realize their color experience is very different from other people's color experience.
So I'm interested in how these conditions are diagnosed, partly because I played a role in Jason finding out that he has prosopagnosia. So I'd sent him a video of Bill Hader on The Tonight Show doing a series of impressions, and he did an impression of Tom Cruise and he does one of Seth Rogen. And the little twist in the video is that AI deepfakes were used to distort Bill Hader's face to superimpose Tom Cruise's face and Seth Rogen's face. And because Jason is interested in AI, I shared the video with him. And he said, I don't get it. What's the big deal about the video? I said, his face literally changes. It's changing into Tom Cruise. And, you can see the beard sprouting with Seth Rogen. He says, I can't see that. And so that kind of got him down the rabbit hole. The one that I've used to sort of demonstrate the story to people is there's a website where they've used footage from No Country for Old Men. and they've subbed in the face with four different actors who are incredibly well-known actors. And the face has shifted, but everything else remains constant. And what I find interesting about that test, as far as I understand from Jason, when he shows it to people in the community, they can't tell that it's a different face. It strikes me as quite a good diagnostic tool. And when I've shown it to my own father, he really struggles. Whereas other friends at the table can immediately tell you, you know, oh, I know exactly who those actors are. And so it seems like some people can really go through their lives not knowing that they have this. They'll just say, I'm bad with names, or, you know, they find some other mechanism for explaining it. I gather the traditional tool is to have these either kind of mugshot pictures of people or like gray 3D models. I wonder what you think about my AI test.
I like your AI test. I'm curious about your dad's difficulty with the No Country for Old Men. So do you think he had difficulty with it because he has difficulty with face recognition, or was he maybe not familiar with the actors who were appearing there?
What's amazing is whenever I show anyone that and they go, I don't know who those people are. And then when I tell them, I mean, it's so I've just not said who it is, but it's well-known actors. Like, it's Arnold Schwarzenegger, it's Leonardo DiCaprio, it's Javier Bardem. So they all know who those actors are. They're very well known. And so he knows who those people are. Often when I say, oh, that's Arnold Schwarzenegger, then he can see it. But before, he can't tell.
Mm. Yeah. That's it. I mean, maybe one thing to say about face recognition ability, and maybe this is obvious because this is probably true for just about every psychological ability, but you know, there's a spectrum of abilities. So there are some people that we've been talking about down here in One Tail who have developmental prosopagnosia. The great majority of people are somewhere in the middle. Maybe I'm 25th percentile would be my guess, although I make these tests, so I can't really test myself with them. And then you've got people in the other tail who are fantastic with faces, and we might want to talk about them later. They're called super recognizers, and they are just mind-blowingly good with face recognition. The way that people with developmental prosopagnosia, there's a wide variety of ways that they come to the realization that their face recognition might be different from others, but it's challenging. The same way that sort of figuring out color deficiency is challenging. I mentioned Bill Schozer, who I wrote my dissertation on. Bill wasn't in his 40s until he realized that he had problems with face recognition. He had severe deficits with it. People with prosopagnosia often know something's wrong. They're not doing very well in social situations or as well as they would like. But they'll often attribute it to more general characteristics like, I'm not trying hard enough. Maybe I just don't care enough about other people. They often feel guilty about it. In Bill's case, he was sitting around watching television with some friends, and there were some close-ups of people in the show. And Bill said to his friends, you know, I wish they wouldn't do that. I don't know who the people are when you get up close to the face. And his friends are like, what are you talking about, Bill? You know, and they got to talking, and Bill realized sort of when you get to the chin or so, he just doesn't get a whole lot out of that part of the body. This is not uncommon. Other sort of situations, you'll have parents who drop their kids off at daycare. The kids change their clothes during the day, and the parent goes to pick up their child. They don't know which kid is theirs. And, you know, if you have a child, I used to not understand this, but now that I have children, like, no way I wouldn't recognize my kids. It's just not going to happen. And so there are often these experiences that sort of really bring it to the fore. And then somebody will go on and Google can't recognize faces. And then there's the question of sort of formal categorization of somebody as having difficulty with faces. And there are a variety of measures that our lab uses, and they're similar to what other labs use. So we'll have people learn a set of faces at the start of a task, and they have to recognize those faces later on, discriminate them from faces they haven't seen before. And then we also use tests of famous face recognition. And so we tend to crop out the hair because people with prosopagnosia often rely on the hair. And then we show the face for, say, 3 seconds, and we see if they can recognize them. And of course, typical control participants, they're not going to recognize every single face, but they're going to do very well. They're going to get like 90% of these faces. And then people with face recognition problems are going to do worse. After the test, we quiz them on their familiarity with the faces. Because if they haven't seen the face, of course, that shouldn't count against their score. But, you know, often they'll say, oh, Brad Pitt was in there. I saw him in a movie 3 weeks ago, and yet I still didn't recognize him. And one last thing is that people with prosopagnosia often realize their difficulties. Well, this is similar to Bill Schozer. They frequently realize it from watching movies and TV. They just can't follow the plot. And they're constantly bothering a partner. Who's that? Who's that? And then they realize, oh, this is not typical.
What is the frequency like? So how often do people get this, or how many people have this? So with prosopagnosia, I've read data somewhere around 2% of the population is classified that way, although I don't know if that's correct. You can tell me. And with PMO, like what percentage of the population or how many people have this?
Yeah. So prosopagnosia is going to depend on where you want to draw the line. So imagine, again, that normal distribution of abilities. There's no clear position that you should be saying, this is prosopagnosia, this is not prosopagnosia. There are going to be fine differences on either side of that line. But typically, if you ask people, if you survey a large group of people and you try to find out how many are having difficulty recognizing, really familiar faces, coworkers, family, acquaintances, their own face, the percentages that people come up with are something like 1 to 2%. 2% is one that's come out of a couple different studies with medical students where they first ask them to fill out a questionnaire, and then people who respond in ways typical of prosopagnosics, then they did one-on-one interviews with those people. So maybe something like 1 in 50. And this sounds right to me. If I give a talk to a fairly large audience, it's common for people to come up afterwards and tell me stories that, they think they're prosopagnosic, and they're able to tell me stories that make me think, yeah, you in fact do have difficulty with faces. With regard to PMO, we don't have a good sense for what the prevalence is. Undoubtedly, it's far rarer than prosopagnosia. If you look in the literature, there have been something like 75 to 80 cases that have been reported over the last 100 or so years. Through our website, we've heard from roughly around 60 people over the last 2.5 years who have face distortions. But we just don't have a good sense. So that's one of the reasons I'm excited to get some more media attention about PMO and see if we start hearing from a lot more people. I'm sure it's never going to be anything like what we're seeing with prosopagnosia, but I'm fairly confident that there are going to be far more people out there than anyone expected a few years ago.
So do either of these conditions track with other traits? So for example, you mentioned that people who've got face blindness might view themselves as not being particularly social. They might think, well, I don't care about other people, or I'm introverted. Could it also track with what their sexual relationships are like, for example? Would you get a higher preponderance of certain sexual orientations? Could people be more or less promiscuous because of it? Maybe they avoid other people, so they're celibate, or maybe they see other people as being much more fluid, so they're very comfortable having orgies. I sort of wonder on that one stage. And then on the other hand, with the PMO, I imagine that could be the kind of thing that could be misdiagnosed. So someone thinks they've got schizophrenia if they say they're seeing demons. Is it the case that the PMO actually does run in parallel with some other conditions?
Yeah, we don't have a good sense. I mean, because our numbers are so small for PMO, we don't have a good sense for that. It won't surprise me if it's more common in psychiatric conditions and or psychiatric conditions are being diagnosed inappropriately in PMO. So we work with one man who his distortions began, and I don't know, 3 days later, a week later, he went into an emergency department and they put him on antipsychotics. And fortunately, he took them for a day or two and then said, I'm not psychotic. That's not the issue here. And he stopped taking them. So I wouldn't be surprised. We're also working with one man who's schizophrenic and sees face distortions. But the base rate of schizophrenia in the normal population is 1%. So that doesn't stand out at this point. But we'll just have to see as we hear from more people. With regard to prosopagnosia, people with developmental prosopagnosia. Oh, I'll go back to PMO after this, but I thought of one more thing. People with developmental prosopagnosia are certainly more likely to have difficulties with other aspects of high-level vision than typical participants are. And so they might, for example, have greater difficulty recognizing scenes they've seen before, recognizing objects. Navigation, which is tied to scene processing, is problematic in many of them. And many of them, so they're defined by having difficulties with facial identity, but I've mentioned the fact that they show elevated rates of difficulty with other aspects of face perception, like attractiveness. We've seen that too, just basic, sort of what many people see as the first step in face perception is just face detection. So you look out into the world and your visual system detects that there's a face somewhere. And many times your attention is just quickly drawn to that face. You've probably had that experience where you're walking and out of the corner of your eye, you just see somebody over there and you just turn. And we're just attracted to faces. Many people have developed, I shouldn't say many, an elevated percentage of people with developmental prosopagnosia have trouble even just detecting a face within a scene. And so that's one of the other commonly co-occurring conditions. You ask about sexual orientation and sexual interests. That's not one of the questions we ask in our intake questionnaire. But one interesting thing, and in fact, this morning in reading the entry from the person who mentioned that they think their attractiveness perception for faces is atypical, is that that person mentioned, I feel like I've seen myself as asexual because I don't find myself attracted to faces. And that's something I've heard from others, and I've wondered about it because it seems like we hear, I don't know what sort of the standard percentage in the population that would call themselves asexual are, but I feel like we're probably hearing from more people than I would have expected. And I think it's a sensible inference to make. You look out at the world and you don't find yourself attracted to men. You don't find yourself attracted to female faces. So you just say, I guess I'm asexual.
So related to this, what is the sort of day-to-day experience life like for PMO and face-blind people? People listening to this might say, well, it sounds like their experience is exactly like ours, except there's something aberrant about their experience. It's a small element of their experience. It's just when they look at faces, but there's the whole of life. Mm-hmm. So is their life just like everyone else's? Does it just track everyday life for everyone else's? Or is the emotional experience of their lives very different?
As you might expect, there are real individual differences there. And so if we're talking about developmental prosopagnosia and acquired prosopagnosia, this holds as well for people who've suffered brain damage and lost the ability to recognize faces. It can be very problematic for people. Probably developmental prosopagnosia is more problematic for people in some sense, because if you've suffered brain damage, people in your office, for example, are probably going to know that. You've had a stroke and then you come back and you're not recognizing them. They're probably more likely to be understanding. On the other hand, if you have developmental prosopagnosia and you fail to recognize the people that you need to recognize to navigate your social world, people often take that quite personally. Imagine you're in the elevator with your supervisor and you walk in, you look at them and you don't acknowledge who they are. People really don't respond well to being blank like that. I think it's seen as a signal that, hey, well, if it's somebody you know well, it's seen as a real affront. If it's somebody you've only met a few times and you don't seem to recognize them, that suggests those previous meetings, they didn't make much of an impact on you. They didn't come across as all that important. And so it creates real difficulties for people. I've had a good number of prosopagnosics sort of break down in tears when thinking about sort of lost job opportunities, lost romantic opportunities that they've had. You know, they walk past some woman that they were in love with, looked right at her, didn't respond to her. It's very hard to explain that to people. People tend to think, if your eyes work, you should be able to recognize me. They don't understand there's all this machinery in our cortex that's necessary to carry out those operations. Then with regard to PMO, PMOs can be very tough on people. They will often, when it first begins, they're really scared. They think their brain is deteriorating. Maybe they're going crazy. We've had a number of people who haven't wanted to talk about it to others, including even close people. So I heard from one woman, I still haven't had an opportunity to talk to her partner, but she had been with her partner for 20 years and he had never told her about the daily distortions that he had. He was, the estimate from her was something like 80 to 100 times per day. He sees faces distort in intense ways. And he'd never told her about it, I assume, because he was ashamed of it and concerned what she would think of him. And he didn't know that other people had these sorts of face distortions. We're working with one young woman in college, and she's seen foreheads seem greatly enlarged. Eyes also are over enlarged when she looks at faces. And she's really isolated herself because of that, because it, not surprisingly, it freaks her out when she looks at people she knows and they look really distorted like this. So that's one of the big reasons that I'm really interested in raising public awareness of PMO. So when, at least when people experience it, they know, ah, this is just a little tweak in my visual system. Yes, it's unpleasant, but it's not a sign that I'm crazy or anything like that. And we're also trying to find ways that we can reduce distortions in people. And it appears there might be some ways that we can do that.
So I'm interested about that. What are the methods that you can use to treat it? And then are these conditions always permanent or are they sometimes merely temporary?
Yeah, I'll answer that first question first about sort of how, whether PMO always persists. It certainly doesn't. So it often, including if you look in the cases in the literature and the cases we've heard from, there's a good number of people who've had face distortions and then they've resolved through no clear reason. They've just kind of gone away one day. In fact, 2 days ago, I was emailing with a woman who, she had distortions that started about 2 years ago, and I was getting in touch to see if she was willing to talk to a journalist, and she was more than willing to talk to the journalist. She was having right hemi PMO, maybe left actually, but anyway, it doesn't matter, hemi PMO, and she's no longer experiencing it any longer. So it's just gone away, and that's not uncommon. There are also some individuals who will just experience a very short period. So I heard from a woman 2 Christmases ago, she was at a holiday party and looked around at the people at the party and she was seeing distortions on a number of the faces. And her first thought, which she laughed at later, was she thought, wow, you know, it's really great. There was a company she just started working for. She said, it's really great that this company really supports people with facial disfigurement. It was really great. And then she realized, wait a second, there aren't that many people with facial disfigurement in this company. And it lasted about 10 minutes and that was the end of it. And she just contacted us to tell us about it. But in other cases, it persists indefinitely. And that's one of the interesting things we're interested in following is just what's the course of PMO? How often does it resolve on its own? Does it sometimes not resolve on its own? And if so, why is that? Then you ask about sort of ways of influencing distortions. And Jason's familiar with some of this. In fact, he's experienced it personally, and maybe he could tell us about it. But one of the things that we've found influences distortions, and I sort of don't like saying this too much because people with PMO will see this, and I don't want it to influence their behavior, but I don't think it's going too much. But when people wear glasses, when the face that's being observed by somebody with PMO has glasses on it, some people, not everybody, but some people with PMO are less likely to see distortions. And we don't know why that is. And we are looking forward to doing simple experiments like, you know, you could take the glasses and put them on the forehead. Does that also reduce distortions? Put them down here. We want to put, say, transparent masks over people's faces. Does that reduce the distortions? And that's the sort of thing that, you know, could be really easy to implement if one has distortions and you're with a couple people in your home, you just say, hey, could you put on these glasses? And then your face is not going to look demonic to me. And then we've also found some interesting effects with color, where certain sorts of colors seem to reduce distortions in some people. And there are other colors that amplify the distortions. And we don't have a good understanding of why this is. It was 2.5 weeks ago, we had a participant here visiting, and we were doing real systematic testing to look at the effect of color on his distortions, and they were pronounced and very consistent. And so, in fact, he's got a pair of glasses. I won't say what color they are, but they're tinted in a color that reduces his distortions. And so if he's going to go to an area where there are crowds, he'll put those glasses on and it helps him manage the situation better.
Yeah. So if I understand correctly, I think the glasses discovery was something I suggested to you guys. And it wasn't something I was fully aware of until I was in the testing. So what happened was the PhD student who was working with me and giving me faces, she said to me after we looked at a whole lot of faces, she said, so I want you to put a number over each forehead in Photoshop in the order that they, how severe the changes were. And the moment I put the number on the forehead, the face stopped changing. And I said, yeah, I've put the number on. That's what it was. But now that I've put the number on, it's not changing at all. And then she said, okay, hold on a moment. Let's try this. And she superimposed a pair of glasses on the face. And I said, yeah, no, it's not changing. And that was a revelation to me. And so, for example, Mark is a very close friend of mine. And I just find his face very pleasant to look at. It's no problem. I can sit across from a table with Mark for 4 hours and his face doesn't change. And it's lovely to have conversations. Whereas if I sit across from a table with someone without glasses, it's quite a challenge to maintain eye contact, maintain a discussion topic. It's not easy. So to me, it was so fantastic to have realized that that was going on. Systematized my experience in that way. And I found other ways of sort of helping my experience. So one of my partners, he has a nose ring, and his face is far less likely to change. So if he takes that nose ring out, it's a lot worse. So since I've met him, he has always worn that nose ring, and that just really helps. And another one is the colored light. And again, I won't say the color because you don't want to influence people who watch this video, but I have RGB lights in my ceiling and in my lamps at home, and I can change that color if necessary. And when I have someone over who has a particularly horrendous face, I ask them if it's okay if I can switch on the particular colored light, and it helps a lot. It's not foolproof. It doesn't always work, but it's a lot better than the wrong type of light. So yeah, these experiences have just made a huge difference. These sort of learnings about how I can manage the experience. I think something that you alluded to earlier, which is that it's a very unpleasant experience when a face changes. You mentioned the university student or the college student who sees enlarged foreheads and enlarged eyes, and she just avoids crowds of people because of it. I mean, for me, there's certain types of faces that change so much more readily than others that if I encounter someone like that, even if they're a lovely person, even if they're objectively attractive, even if they're fascinating, interesting, funny, intelligent, I just won't want to spend time with that person. And even before that first distortion happens, I know that that's the kind of face that's going to distort, and I'll avoid that person. And I mean, that's maybe a tragedy for people with face distortions, is that they're avoiding certain types of experiences in their lives.
So the philosopher Derek Parfit, who's kind of regarded as one of the most influential modern philosophers, it sounds like he had a condition called aphasia, where he would struggle to form visuals in his mind. I had a philosophy professor at university who had the same condition. And I asked him a couple of things like, well, how do you navigate? And he said, well, I just have a list in my head. So I don't kind of have a movie in my head that's playing of where I need to go. I have this other system in place that, you know, I know once you've gone 200 meters, you must take a left. And so before I knew that Jason was face blind, he told me that he also couldn't form these sort of visual memories and struggles to have visual dreams, and says that he dreams conceptually. And it struck me that there's a skill that you end up developing that you and I wouldn't develop because of it. So that ability to think in concepts all the time is going to be really useful if you're a philosopher, because, you know, this is our stock in trade. And so I wonder if you found that there are certain benefits that people have gained through this.
Yeah. I think you're thinking in particular prosopagnosia, or you mentioned aphantasia, where people don't experience visual imagery, they experience greatly reduced visual imagery. I can't say that, you know, we've heard from a disproportionate number of philosophers through faceblind.org. We do hear from a really intelligent group of individuals, but I've attributed that to them just becoming aware, being more likely to become aware of prosopagnosia, having the motivation to contact us, that sort of thing. So I don't think we've seen that, but it's not the sort of thing I think we could easily pick up on. And so it's certainly plausible that that's going on. We're involved right now, or my lab is involved in a study with the UK Biobank, in which we're going to be trying to measure face recognition ability. I don't know how many of your listeners are familiar with the UK Biobank, but it's a huge study. It involves 500,000 people. They've done a lot of cognitive testing with them, lots of health. It's very health focused. So, and then they've also got DNA from all these individuals. So we're going to be sending them surveys that ask about their ability to generate visual imagery and also their ability to recognize faces. And so we're going to get the best measure of the association between visual imagery ability and face recognition ability quite in the coming months. And so we'll have a good answer, at least for how tightly related they are. It seems that they are. We do seem to hear from a disproportionate number of people who have aphantasia through faceblind.org. And it makes sense. I mean, if you've got some developmental problems in one region of cortex, it's likely that neighboring regions, or it's more likely that neighboring regions aren't going to develop normally either.
So when you look at the brains of people, either with prosopagnosia or with PMO, and I'm sure they're going to be very different types of brains, but when you look at their brains, can you always pick up the source? So is there a structural difference in that person's brain, or is it just that it functions differently sometimes? But if you just look at the gray matter, it looks the same.
Yeah, no, we're not anywhere close to being able to pick it out at the individual level. If we look at a group of people with developmental prosopagnosia, let's say we've got 25 people maybe, and we compare them to 25 control participants, we're probably likely to be able to see some structural differences in right temporal lobe. So there might be greater gray matter density, just a measure of sort of neural packing in some of these regions, how large some of these regions are. We can also see differences if we do functional measurements. So we're measuring blood flow while participants are looking at faces and looking at objects. We can look at the difference in their response to faces and objects, say in the face selective areas. We'll see that the prosopagnosics are showing a reduced response to faces compared to people with the typical face processing. That's at the group level, though. If these are the distributions of, say, 25 and 25 individuals, there's a lot of overlap between these two distributions. I'm now working with a guy at MIT, though. We're taking a different approach where we're looking at the response to individual images. We show people 185 images. They see each image four times. Four times? I don't know how many times. Maybe more than that. And we get a good estimate about what their response is to that particular image. And we have some evidence suggesting that we're actually able to pick out whether an individual person with developmental prosopagnosia is different from controls, but we need to do more work there. But I think there, you know, we'll be there in 10, 15 years, but we're not there yet. And when it comes to PMO, very little is known about the neural basis of PMO. If you look in people who've suffered brain damage, and so these are the people in the neurological literature, more than half of the cases in which you've got hemi-PMO, so just distortions affecting half the face, you see damage to a white matter bundle that connects the left hemisphere visual areas to the right hemisphere visual areas. It's called the splenium. More than half the people with hemi-PMO have damage to this white matter connecting the two hemispheres. And so that looks like it's critical. Why that would be the case, I don't know. It's one interesting sort of aspect of acquired prosopagnosia versus face distortions is that there's damage to the face processing network in both, but in some cases you get just the inability to recognize facial identity and often other aspects of faces. And other times you actually get active distortions to the faces. And we don't know what's driving that. One really simple, almost certainly inaccurate distinction you might say is, well, maybe it's gray matter leads to prosopagnosia, white matter damage. So the connections between different brain regions leads to face distortions because of this association with splenium. Probably not going to be true, but it's a place to start and explore at least.
So if you had someone with PMO come to your lab, what battery of tests would you put them through?
Yeah. So even before they come to our lab, we run them on a lot of Zoom-based tasks and we show them stimuli. I could talk about, in fact, some studies that we ran Jason through that provided really interesting data. So we might, for example, show them an upright face and we see where their distortions are on that face. And so in Jason's case, it's going to be on the right-hand side of the face. Then we can do things like turn that face in the picture plane. And so we turn it 90 degrees, we turn it 180 degrees, we turn it 270 degrees, and we see where the distortion is on the face at different orientations. What we found in Jason's case, as well in a patient in Portugal who we did testing with a few years back, or a colleague of mine did, we found in both those cases, the distortion sticks with the features on the face as you turn it over. So if they were on this side of the face as you, when they, you see it upright, it sticks to that same side of the face as you turn the face. And so that suggests to us that face processing involves what we call a face-centered representation. So every face that you encounter as you walk through the world, you take that perception of the face and you fit it to this template that matches it up regardless. It might have come in upside down. You rotate it and fit it in there. And that's an advantageous way to do face processing because then the faces that you're perceiving, you can compare them nicely to faces that you already have in memory because you've standardized them in terms of size and orientation and all this sort of thing. It makes it easier to determine whether you've got a match. And so Jason showed this effect where the features stick. This other person, AD, showed the same thing. And that was some of the first good evidence for this face-centered representation, which is the exact same way that most machine vision systems do it. So it's nice to see those parallels between humans and machines. So what do we do with people with PMO? Really depends on what we're after with them. I mean, the first thing to do is just characterize the distortions that they have so we get an understanding of that. We find that in some cases, asymmetries between the two halves of the face influence their distortions. So we'll do things like reduce the symmetry or increase the symmetry of the two halves of the face and see if that influences their distortions. We'll also show them half faces because if it's asymmetries between the two halves driving their distortion, they shouldn't have a distortion when we show them half faces. And we do see that in some cases. Now all of a sudden they're not seeing distortions on the face. And then one thing that we're real interested in looking at going forward is the relationship between conscious face perception and the decisions that you make about faces. Because one of the interesting things that you see when you look in the literature about people with face distortions is, for the most part, they seem to be pretty good at recognizing faces. They know who the person is that they're looking at, despite the fact that they say that it's distorted. Now, I don't think there have been real good tests of this, but it raises the possibility that maybe the representations that give rise to our conscious experience of faces are different than the representations we use to make decisions about faces. And so we're going to want to run experiments where we increase or decrease the extent of the distortions that somebody's seen, and then to see how that influences the judgments they're making about faces. You know, who are you seeing? We can measure response time. How quickly can they recognize that face? What facial expression are you seeing? How masculine or feminine that face is, all the different things, sorts of information that we get from faces. And that would be really interesting to, if that dissociation exists, it would parallel a finding between perception and action. So this has been well established for 30 years now. There are some people who you'll show them something and you'll say, what do you see? And they'll say, I can't see a thing. So if you ask them, what's the orientation of my hand? They'll say, I can't tell you what the orientation of your hand is. But then you say, imagine that the you've got a slot. They can't report the orientation of a slot. But then you say, I want you to take this letter and I want you to put the letter in the slot. So they're actually carrying out an action. There's a patient named DF who, even though she can't tell you what the orientation is, she can put the letter right into the slot just as well as you and I can. And what appears to be going on is her visual processing in her parietal stream, called the dorsal stream, that's functioning normally. She's got damage, though, to the ventral stream that's running along the base of the temporal lobe. And so she's got a dissociation between conscious visual perception, which is damaged in her, and vision for action. And so here we might be seeing something similar with faces.
So is the idea that the person with face distortions who has PMO is seeing the face accurately behind the distortion? There's some part of their brain that's perceiving it correctly, and then the brain's doing a whole lot of processing work and messing it up. So there, you talked about the template earlier that you're putting a brain onto. That template is sort of cognitive work on top of the initial perception, and that template is damaged in some way, but the initial perception is accurate.
Yeah. I mean, at some point, and it's not always the template that's the problem. We see that in some of these cases. But you can imagine at some point, you know, when there's activity on your retina, everything's fine. And then as you go to the next step, you go to the thalamus, things are still fine. At some point along the pathway of visual processing, things go awry. You can imagine there's a split in terms of facial information, and there's one pathway that's not functioning properly. And that's what that gives rise to your conscious experience of faces. But then there's another pathway that's doing its thing normally, and maybe that's what's driving your decisions about faces. Now, this is only a hypothesis. It needs to be tested. But it's something we plan to look into soon, and I think it's a tractable issue with PMO.